need to worry. Today, I promise you, you will learn something really valuable. And you will also see how the story from Esther chapter 5 ties in to the main message of resurrection at the end. So if you have your bulletins with you, the outline, right? I encourage you to keep your outline right in front of you. And we are going to talk about the iffy appointment. And then we are going to learn about Esther's intriguing invitations. Then we're going to switch to see this bad guy, Haman, his ill-fated indignation. And then we'll end with a tie-in to the incomparable offer that Jesus Christ offers to us. So let me start by asking all of you, okay, this is first the question to the students. Have you ever experienced an iffy appointment, such as being called into the principal's office, not knowing whether you are in trouble, but sometimes your principal may want to call you in to surprise you first with the good news that you won an award or a special scholarship? Or those of us in the working world, how about being called into your boss's office during a time of company-wide layoffs, or your company just merged with another company, and it's that appointment with the big boss, two levels up, it's iffy because you don't know whether you're going to be laid off or if you will be one of the few people who will be retained under the new management. Or how about this feeling? I hope you never had to experience this, but some of us have experienced going into the doctor's office with your spouse to find out the results of your biopsy or your CAT scan. It's scary because you dread to find out if you have cancer or not. So that's why it's an iffy appointment when the odds of a good outcome of that appointment are against you. See, that's how today's Esther chapter 5 begins for Esther. You see, last week, Queen Esther was challenged by her uncle Mordecai to go beg the king for mercy for such a time as this. Because this bad guy, Haman, who had a lot of power, he was a prime minister of Persia at the time, he came up with a plan to destroy and annihilate all the Jewish people on one single day. But there was this protocol that anyone who approached the king without first being summoned by the king will be put to death. So those were the incredible odds. In fact, by this time, Esther was the queen, but she didn't see the king for 30 days already. So she thought, if the king didn't think about me for 30 days now, the chances are not likely that he wants to see me. So that was the danger and the odds that Esther felt. So here's Esther chapter 5. On the third day, remember those of us who were here last week, Esther asked all the Jewish people to fast and pray for her for 3 days. So after that was completed, on the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the palace in front of the king's hall. The king was sitting on his royal throne in the hall facing the entrance. When he saw Queen Esther standing in the court, he was pleased with her and held out to her the gold scepter that was in his hand. So Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. Everybody knows in those old days, the Pharaoh and the kings, they had what's called a scepter, right? A scepter is a symbol of royalty. And so we learn from this book of Esther that King Ahasuerus or King Xerxes, if he was going to grant favor to anybody coming to see the king, me unannounced, okay, Fung, I'm going to extend my royal scepter to you, and you have to touch the tip. Then the guards won't kill you, okay? So just so that you have an understanding of what the protocol was during that time. And let's continue reading. Then the king asked, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be given you." Isn't that incredible? In a split instant, Esther goes from fearing for her life, not knowing whether the king will accept her or not, to being offered half of his kingdom. Isn't that an incredible role or a switcheroo? It's incredible. Now, I'm going to start, but I promise you, there's at least four practical tips you can learn from today's story. And why this is such a good story is when you want something from your authority. So, of course, youth, when you want something from your parents to let you go to that prom or prom weekend or to have you take out your car, right? Or when young people, you want to have a special day off during an upcoming weekend to go to your friend's wedding, so you want to take an extra day off or something, and you want to ask your mean boss for a special holiday, right? Or those of us who are married, right, the big boss, right, when you want to get your spouse's permission to go someplace or do something with the guys or the gals, right? All of us need to understand, and we can learn, how do you get something from your authority? So tip number one, always be prepared to answer what is your request. So I'm trying to get you this scenario. You're so scared of going to your parents to ask for this request. You're so scared to go to your boss to ask for the request. And when you're in front of the boss or your parents, oh my goodness, your dad is in such a good mood. Like, usually your dad never pays attention to you. Usually your husband never listens to your nagging. Usually your boss will never let you come into his office. But on this special day, maybe he had a promotion. Maybe he had a bonus. All of a sudden, the boss or the authority that you want to get permission from, all of a sudden kind of hugs you to say, "Vincent, so nice to see you. What do you want? What can I do for you?" Or the boss says that to you. All right, so be prepared. So those of us in the corporate world, this is called being ready for your one-minute elevator speech. And for college students, you need to know this. All salespeople know this. Very rarely do you get a chance to talk to the big, big boss, somebody who's in charge. So when that boss, you catch them in a good mood, or you kind of go into the elevator, and in the elevator is the president of your company or CEO, you only got 1 minute. You better be prepared with a speech that says, that puts you in the best possible light to explain, "Oh, Mr. CEO, I have an idea for you." And then you kind of give the idea right off the bat, all right? Or I'll give you an example. When the young people, you go through many interviews, and then you're so surprised. On your third and final interview, the interviewers like you so much, so the hiring manager says, "Oh, by the way, Enoch, we're going to offer you a job now. What would you like for your starting salary?" You need to be prepared to answer this question. What is your request? All right, let's continue on. This is what I call the intriguing invitations, the title of my sermon. Look what Esther did. Esther's response was, "If it pleases the king," replied Esther, "let the king, together with Haman, come today to a banquet I have prepared for him." Okay, again, just so you can wrap around how Esther's response was so unexpected or unconventional, let me share with you what my response would be. If I was Esther, having the burden of having to represent my whole Jewish people, and we talked about it, there could have been as much as 10 million Jewish people living in the whole kingdom of Persia, and I go to see the king, and all of a sudden, the king is in such a good mood. The king said, "Esther, what is it that you want? You can have up to half of my kingdom." I'm telling you, what if I were Esther, I would say, "Fantastic, king, I'll take it." before you change your mind, because I would think if I have control over half the army, then at least it's 50-50. When some people start to destroy my Jewish people, I have half of the king's army to combat that, right? So this is my logical thinking. But Esther, because she is so wise, because all these people pray for her, she comes up with an extraordinarily wise answer. She starts off by saying, if it pleases the king, she invites them to a banquet. And she only invites the king, the key decision maker, and then she invites Haman. And here again, if I was a fly in the wall, I said, Esther, what are you doing? Haman is your nemesis. He's the one who wants to destroy you. What are you doing? Why are you inviting Haman to this banquet? But then the king says, bring Haman at once. The king says, so that we may do what Esther asks. Tip number two. This is the key, you guys. Esther, knowing that I have to ask a really, really unusual big request from my authority, she starts off by saying, if it pleases the king. This is when the youth, you say, Mom, Dad, if it pleases you, boss, if it pleases you, you know what? You know why this is so effective? Because this is what Esther was doing. She was acknowledging the authority of the king, Xerxes. He knows that you offered half the kingdom to me, but you are still the king. Mom, Dad, I know you like me, but you still call the shots. In the end, I'm under 18 years old. I have to obey you. You acknowledge your authority, and then you affirm your authority. That's what Esther did. Not only acknowledge that, king, you hold all the power, but he says, if it pleases you, which means she is validating that you need to be happy first. You need to be pleased first. So this is a tremendously wise principle that all of us can use dealing with whatever authority that we deal with. Okay, now let's continue on. So the king and Haman went to the banquet Esther had prepared. As they were drinking wine, the king again asked Esther, Esther, now what is your petition it will be giving you? And what is your request? And then he emphasizes again, even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted. This is incredible what the king was offering to Esther. Now, it's intriguing because Esther does the unconventional again. Esther replied, my petition and my request is this. If the king regards me with favor, and if it pleases the king, that phrase again, to grant my petition and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come tomorrow to the banquet. I will prepare for them. Notice how patient Esther is. She knows that God is on her side. She doesn't have to do what she, humanly point of view, have to do. And notice she uses the term, if it pleases the king, but two times. Because she also says in verse 8, if the king regards me with favor. So smart, always acknowledging that you have the power and I need to please you, right? Very, very smart. And after she does this again, yeah, true. She is buttering up the king. You need to butter up your parents. You need to butter up your boss. And you need to butter up your professor when you ask him to change your grade from an A minus to an A plus. Okay. Okay, but that's what Esther does. That's what Esther does. And then she finally says, then I will answer the king's question. So on the second banquet, she still doesn't give the answer. What do we learn from this? Practical tip number three. Use the hook, line, and sinker approach to catch a big fish. I mean, we're talking about a big fish. Now, all the fishermen, how many of you like fishing here? Raise your hand. Not too many people like fishing, but it's okay. You can understand this. When fishermen go fishing, you have to have a bait, right? Typically, it's a worm, and sometimes you have different types of bait. But on the hook, you have to put the bait. And in colloquial terms, when you want somebody to do something, especially all marketers know that every single advertisement we do, whether it's on newspapers or digital or posters, you have to have a hook. So Esther's hook was this home-cooked meal, because by now you should know that this King Xerxes, he loves banquets, right? He loves banquets. So that was her hook. Then the line, right? So all of you, even if you're not a fisherman, to the hook and the bait the worm, there's a line, right? And you got the fishing rod, right? You cast the fishing rod into the lake or the sea, and the fish may first start to nibble at your bait, nibble at the worm. Now, inexperienced fishers, or fishermen, or fisherwomen, like I was when I was a teenager, when I see the bobblehead go down, I would immediately try to pull it, to pull the fish, or I may try to reel it in. But, of course, my uncle will tell me, no, don't do that, because some fish are smart, too. They're not going to bite the whole thing all at once and hook the mouth and the gill into the hook. They're going to nibble first. So if you were to yank your fishing rod or yank the line, the fish will be scared and run away or swim away. So, in fact, they will tell you, when you see the bobble go down or something, let it out. Give it some more line so the fish can actually nibble at the bait and take it to what the fish thinks is a more secure location, maybe away from other fish, to nibble more, bite more, to eat it. So you kind of gotta extend the line until the fish mouth goes really right into the hook. So the hook will grab the fish's mouth through the gill, right? So that's the analogy over here. So Esther was not giving the yank when the king asked her the first question, not when the king asked her the second question. In fact, Esther said, you got to come to my second banquet, and then I will tell you the answer. That's what Esther was doing. Now, hook, line, and sinker. Even if you're not a fisherman, do you know what the sinker is? Okay. The sinker, as the name implies, is a weight. So when people go fishing, maybe deep sea fishing or into a deep lake, you want to have your bait go down to where the big fish is, right? So you have to have an anchor, if you will. You have to have a weight that will bring the hook and the bait all the way down. That's the sinker. It has a very important function in fishing. So do you guys want to guess what Esther's sinker was? Esther, Isaac, go ahead, guess it. Esther's sinker was the wine, because those of us who've been reading through Esther 1, 2, 3, 4, Xerxes loves to drink and get drunk. Haman also loves to drink and get drunk. So Esther really knew the whole hook, line, and sinker approach. All right, now let's continue on. The ill-fated indignation. So now the switch. If we were watching a movie, the scene switches to Haman. Verse 9, Haman went out that day happy and in high spirits. This is after the first private banquet between Esther, King Xerxes, and Haman. So, of course, they drank in the first banquet, so he's in high spirits. But when he saw Mordecai at the king's gate and observed that he neither rose nor showed fear in his presence, he was filled with rage against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home. Calling together his friends, and now we see his wife, Zeresh, Haman boasted to them about his vast wealth, his many sons, and all the ways the king had honored him, and how he had elevated him above the other nobles and officials. And that's not all, Haman added. I'm the only person the queen, Esther, invited to accompany the king to the banquet she gave earlier that day. And she has invited me along with the king tomorrow. A lot of times when all these young adults get married, I'm so jealous, you know, the people who get invited to the bachelor's party bachelorette party, okay? And then if you get lucky enough to go get invited to the wedding reception, nowadays they have even the after party too, you know? So this is Haman. He's like, The only other person that's higher ranking than me is the king and the queen, and I get to go to their banquet. But look, listen to what Haman said. He said, "But all this gives me no satisfaction as long as I see that Jew Mordecai sitting at the king's gate." So, practical tip number four, don't make a mountain out of a molehill. If I were there again, an advisor flying, I would have told Haman, are you crazy? You just bragged to your wife and to all your friends. You got the number two most powerful position in the whole Persian kingdom. You just bragged about how wealthy you are, how much money you have. Then you also bragged that you have many sons, right? Many successful, capable sons. And you've bragged about being invited to the queen's banquet, right? So why are you so upset and downcast just because one little old man in the palace doesn't stand up to you or bow down to you when there are thousands of other officials and people in the royal palace that do bow down to you and almost worship you, right? So the practical point here is don't make a mountain out of a molehill. And that's why to all of you, this is a wise tip or reminder that we should never, ever let one single person or one small irritation really bother us to sap our joy and energy. There's so many good things going on in your life, and no matter how smart you are, no matter how successful you are, no matter how kind and generous you are, I guarantee you there will always be somebody who is either envious or jealous of you, or who just doesn't agree with you, or who just doesn't like you. So the practical tip here is let it go. Don't sweat the small stuff. There is no way every single person in your school or in your company or in your church or your neighborhood will like you and support you. And especially so, you guys, in social media, right? You know, you're not a guy who's on the social media every single day, but on this one time, you have this great picture you post, or you have a great comment you post, and you hope that some of your closest friends will like it, but they don't. Same thing. Don't feel bad just because the people who want it, you wanted them to like your post, doesn't. Most likely, they were too busy, they didn't even see that post. So this principle is so important to all of us. Don't make a mountain out of a molehill. But Haman did. So let's see what happened. And the reason why Haman did it is because he is basically an insecure person. Usually, when a person is so into themselves, an egomaniac, a selfish person, they tend to be a very insecure person. And so on the outline, I talk about the vengeful advice of his wife, Zeresh. And here's why I call this a vengeful advice of his wife, Zeresh. His wife, Zeresh, and all his friends said to him, "Have a pole set up reaching to the height of 50 cubits, that's 25 yards or 75 feet, and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai impaled on it. Then go with the king to the banquet and enjoy it." So can you believe a wife saying this? This suggestion delighted Haman, and he had the pole set up. Okay. Good news and bad news. There's something that Zeresh did well. Because earlier I said, when you're talking to somebody who has more authority over you, you should acknowledge that person and affirm their feelings, right? So Zeresh did a good job. Zeresh found out, my husband, who is the second most powerful person in this whole empire, is upset, depressed, sad. So she understood that, she acknowledged that, and she kind of affirmed that because she comes up with a vengeful plan to make him feel better. So from that point of view, she was a smart wife. But what's good for the short term may not be good for the long run, because for the long run, it was a bad advice. And that's why I call it the ill-fated indication. Okay, so all of my regeneration regulars, okay, spoiler alert. Could you hold your hand? I'm going to reveal what's going to happen two chapters from now. And if you want to have everything suspense build up, you know, spoiler alert, put your hands over yours. And for the people over here, the youth, the reason why I say this was an ill-fated indignation is because two chapters later, the very same poll that was set up for Mordecai, Haman gets impaled on it. And the reason why, okay, now, spoiler alert's over. The reason why this was so vengeful is this. The name of Mordecai in Persian means short man, little man. So many Bible scholars believe that Mordecai indeed was short. So, 50 cubits is 25 yards. Any of you who go swimming, a typical swimming pool in the YMCA or in your school is 25 yards long, the length. So, whereas only 5 cubits or 7.5 feet would have been sufficed to kind of hang a man or impale a man because Mordecai was a short man, the wife suggests this pole to be 10 times as big, like 25 yards high. And that's just pure spite, right? Just to emphasize the fact that you're little, you're short, but we're going to, in one sense, crucify you, impale you, and a pole so high so that the whole town of Susa can see you and mock you and humiliate you, right? That's why it was really, really vengeful. Okay. Now, I'm going to wrap it up now because we have baptism, and that's why I'm sorry. I guess people figured it out. The region kids had no children's sermon. But let me just summarize for you, like I promised you, 4 practical tips we learned from Esther. Number one was, well, you should be prepared to answer this question, what you really want. Okay, I'll tell you why this is so important to you guys, especially young people. Suppose you went to your parents and said, Mom, Dad, will you allow me to go on an international mission trip to Taiwan, right? That's why you felt led or called by God to go on any kind of an overseas mission trip. And then you catch your parents in such a good mood, they say, son, this summer, your dad, your father, and I were planning to go to Taiwan on vacation, so why don't you just come with us and just have a good time for the 2 to 3 weeks during the month of July? This is a good example of how you need to know what you really want, what your mission is, because sometimes God may present a test to you to say, well, instead of working hard on a mission trip, why don't you just have fun in Taiwan? What do? You need to really be prepared for your ask, what you really want out of this mission. The second practical advice is, like I said, to publicly acknowledge and affirm your authority. The third thing is to use hook, line, and sinker, especially to catch a big fish. And the fourth one is don't make a mountain out of a molehill. Don't sweat the small stuff. Okay, but I really want to end the more important thing. These were all like fun, practical things you learned from Esther. But the most important thing is what this story does at this juncture is to give you a comparison, the incomparable offer. Because what I really want you to understand is just as Esther knew that there was no way she can approach the king without him extending the gold scepter to her, or else she would have been killed by the other guards in the palace, right? It's really the same way that unless we come to God the Father through Jesus Christ, in one sense, he is the gold setter, there is no way you can approach God. And I want to end with this story. And the story is true. In the Old Testament times, God was considered so holy that nobody dare look at God or they'll be blinded or they'll die. Even Moses always had to be shielded. Isaiah, the different prophets, they all, when they thought they had God coming and talking to them, they say, stay away from me for I'm a sinner, right? So when in the Old Testament, God instructed the Israelites to create this Jerusalem temple, he instructed them to have 3 parts. First, there was the outer court. Then there was the middle court, but we call it the inner court. And then the Holy of Holies. So, all the Jewish men were allowed into the first outer court. And if you go to Jerusalem, the Western Wall, there's the main section, only the men can go. They don't allow the women to go. But now they created a special section for the women to go. Then in the inner court, only the priests were allowed there. But in the Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant, right? If you watch Raiders of the Lost Ark, or if you study, pay attention during Sunday school, in the Ark of the Covenant was Moses' rod. There were elements of manna and the Ten Commandment tablets. God was said, that is my presence. And so only one person in all of Israel, the high priest, was able to go enter into the Holy of Holies because God was so holy. And not only that, it was so holy that this high priest, he couldn't go into the Holy of Holies any time. Only one day a week, and most of you have Jewish friends, you know Yom Kippur, right? One day a week, the high priest is supposed to bring the best unblemished lamb, sacrifice it to atone for the sins of all the people. And I just found out that when the high priest on that one appointed day were to enter into the Holy of Holies to represent all of the Jewish people and to ask for God's forgiveness, I found out that the rest of the Levite priests, they tied a rope around the waist of the high priest. And the reason why is because when the high priest were to go in, right, he had to first sacrifice the animal himself to confess his own personal sins to be clean to go in. So perhaps he didn't do a good job of confessing for your own sins. So when you go into the Holy of Holies, maybe God will strike him dead. Or if you believe in the Raiders of the Lost Ark stories, maybe he goes in and he mistakenly touches the Ark of the Covenant and he's zapped right away. So really, literally, so the rest of the Levite priests felt there could always be a chance that even the holiest priest in our tribe can still be struck dead by entering in the presence of God. So if they didn't hear from him, they would use that rope to pull him back up because nobody would dare go into the Holy of Holies to retrieve the dead body. And that's why when Jesus Christ hung on that cross and when he said his final word, it is finished, if you read the Bible, it will tell you the earth shook and quaked, the clouds went dark, and when Jesus Christ gave up his soul, the curtain that separated the Holy of Holies and the inner court, it was, the Bible says it was ripped in two from the top to bottom, symbolically, actually, to say, from this point onwards, no human being needs to go to another priest, anybody else, to have access to God the Father. That Jesus Christ was our sacrifice, and Jesus Christ is our golden scepter. He is the access to God the Father. Let's pray.